So I'd like to welcome everyone to the fourth Opossi Rounds. And I'm really excited about the topic today. By the way, those of you who are sitting around the room, please feel free to move up to the table. We'd love to have you sitting here. So when we started to put Opossi Rounds together, we were thinking about issues and trans and what we could learn from experiments that were already ongoing. And so we're thrilled today to have two people who don't need to be introduced to this audience, Story and Tom, tell us about the experience that they've had with the neuroscience blueprint, both the specifics of the neuroscience blueprint, but also lessons learned, and what we can discuss at the end is how this would apply to other trans NIH initiatives. So I think, Dr. Insel, are you first? Or?
Well, thanks, Alan, for setting this up. I believe a story pointed this out as we walked in that this may actually be the first time that we have talked about the neuroscience blueprint to the IC directors as well as to the NIH community. So this is long overdue, and we're delighted to have a chance to fill people in on a project that's been going since about 2004. This project actually started with, as I recall, two bottles of Chianti and about four plates of pasta that were served family style. I stand corrected. Four bottles of Chianti.
I actually don't remember any of it.
Exactly. So it gives you a sense of how we began, which was with a very nice dinner that Dr. Zerhouni invited many of us to early in 2004. And the rationale for this at that time was we were about 1 year post the beginning, or the, at least giving birth to the roadmap. And there was a very enthusiastic response to that as a new trans NIH initiative, both from people on the Hill as well as people in the scientific community and people on the NIH campus. And my sense was, and Dr. Zerhouni can fill us in more on this, is that at that time, he was looking really for the next grand challenge. He looked around. He had just recruited five IC directors for neuroscience institutes, NIDA, NIMH, NIAAA, NINDS, and arguably NIGMS, which Jeremy Berg had just come. And I don't know whether we call that a neuroscience institute, but we'll include him for this purpose. And so he was thinking about bringing this group together and crafting something that could be a new vision for neuroscience in the same way that we had done for the roadmap. In addition to the new vision opportunity, I think there was at the same time this increasing recognition of the huge burden of illness that came about from nervous system disorders. And as it shows on this slide, six of the top 10 causes of death, one in three Americans, $500 billion per year, about 1,000 disorders in total accounted for by CNS diseases, collectively the most common cause for hospitalization in the United States. So recognizing that there was a public health mandate to do something more and potentially trans in neuroscience. And then I think the third possibility here was recognizing this extraordinary scientific opportunity around that time. The Society for Neuroscience, and I believe actually that was the year that Dr. Landis was elected to be their president, put out a wonderful little document about the importance of the brain, in which they start by saying that this is the most complex living thing in the universe, maybe slightly hyperbolic, but the fact is that we were poised to begin to try to understand this very complicated organ system, which unlike the kidney and the gut, the liver, the heart, the lung, remained very much a frontier area in the sense that there were still so many fundamentals that we did not know about how the brain developed, how it connected, even what the different kinds of cells were in the cortex. And yet this complex and still very mysterious organ system served as arguably the primary organ system for about 16 of the institutes, centers, and offices at the NIH listed here. So this is the group that came together with Dr. Zerhouni's leadership to form this blueprint. The original conception was that this would be to coordinate research and planning across these 16 entities. There was a lot of discussion about how to share best practices and resources. And as Story will say in a few minutes, we ultimately came to a set of three themes, which we rolled out annually as the topics or concepts that we wanted to build projects around. In terms of the budget, there was an initial commitment of about $100 million over 5 years, much less than 1% of the total budgets from those, that's about 0.3% of the budgets from these various ICs. It's important to recognize that even in 2004, before we laid this new framework out, there was already a lot of collaboration between many of these institutes. So it would not be fair to say that we lived completely in silos before this time. In fact, on the intramural side, you could argue that we had mostly ripped down the walls between the various institutes, not only through the website that was developed for intramural neuroscience and through seminar series, but the embodiment of this really was in the Porter Neuroscience Building, which was organized entirely by scientific themes and not by institutes. On the extramural side, as you can see here, we counted in 2004 alone, before the blueprint, 110 RFAs and program announcements, and about 23% of those were collaborative in the sense that they involved three or more ICs with a total commitment of $60 million. But what this did was to launch a series of new efforts, and what we'll do over the next few minutes is take you through some of them. By my count, there have been about 20 RFAs altogether. I'm not going to take you through all 20, but I will share with you some exemplars so you can get a sense of the kinds of things that we try to do. And then Story will help us to think about these last two or three years, how the themes have developed, and we hope to end up by talking about some lessons learned, what's been good, what's been not so good, and then leave most of the time for discussion. So let me tell you about just a few of these very quickly. In the very beginning, that is, I have to confess that we were a little bit slow on the uptake. So as I remember, that Italian dinner was in February, and it was a few phone calls later when Elias, I think in August or September, said, "Hey, whatever happened? I might have paid the bill for the dinner, but that was kind of a down payment, and you guys are supposed to move ahead with this without my prodding you." And so we finally did get going later in 2004. But we felt that we wanted to jumpstart some projects. So one of the things that we did, unlike the roadmap, is we didn't have a series of large public meetings. We got together as groups of program officers, IC directors, thought about where the opportunities were. The first one was to do this neuroscience information framework, which was essentially simply trying to capture the landscape of what was out there already. What were the resources? What were the tools? How were they accessed? What could anybody in the community currently get, and what did they need? This was led by David Shurtleff from NIDA. When I first described this, I was calling it a sort of yellow pages for neuroscientists. I have to tell you, I used that analogy talking about the genome. A couple of weeks ago, I was giving a talk to graduate students at Rockefeller. I said that, you know, having the human genome sequence was like having a white pages. What we really needed was the yellow pages. And all I got around the room were these quizzical expressions, and I realized that graduate students have no idea what the yellow pages are anymore. I actually expected someone to pull out his iPhone and start Googling yellow pages as if this was the hot new thing that you could do on the web. Let's call this not the yellow pages, but a database of databases. And it was a combined effort with the Society for Neuroscience that had very much the same interest. And over a couple of years, put together essentially this catalog, which was web-based, open access, entirely searchable, and provided for the community. It's not quite complete, but will provide for the community an opportunity to find out what's out there in terms of tools and databases that can be easily accessed for neuroscientists. A second project, and again, this is a bit different than what we did in the roadmap, was to say, we've got some really great things going currently between two, sometimes three institutes. Let's expand them. So this was one such project. It was the Microarray Consortium that was already quite successful. It's a project that was combined NINDS and NIMH, and we said, let's open this up much more broadly. So we did that, again, in 2005. Over the past couple of years, there have been 43 investigators, projects from 37 PIs who do not have NIMH or NINDS funding, so would not have been able to access this previously. And then another 40 projects from 25 PIs who had NIMH or NINDS funding but were actually using this for projects that were based on funding from another institute. So in total, it's roughly about 80 projects that have gone into this microarray consortium that would not have been possible without the neuroscience blueprint. What we did here essentially then was to take something that was working well and expand its access, expand some of its capabilities to make it better. In 06, one of the projects was to develop these P30s. These were these interdisciplinary cores. This is, again, taking a best practice, one that had been used widely by NEI and a few other institutes. In this case, we wanted to use this for, I think there were four ultimately funded out of 44 applications, but to support areas of technology development where multiple PIs would be supported across many, many different institutes. So as it says here, 15 Blueprint IC neuroscience projects with funding from at least four Blueprint ICs. Lots of opportunities here. We looked at a whole series of interesting grants that came in, NINDS. Tom Miller took the lead on this. And again, it's too early to see the outcome from this, but we think that particularly around neuroimaging and around areas where we needed large amounts of informatics development, we could do something here through these P30s that would have been difficult to do through conventional mechanisms. And just two other projects to give you a sense of how this worked. The training programs were areas that we thought would also be quite useful for a trans effort. If you just step back and think about it, neuroscience training would be applicable to virtually all of the ICs and centers and offices that were involved in the blueprint. It's only been really by convention that we've developed these as IC-specific training programs. These are a few examples of the kinds of things that we've rolled out. The T32s for neurobiology of disease, computational neuroscience, the T90, and then this very interesting project around getting training in, from physics to physiology for neuroimaging. And here again, NIDA has taken the lead, and we've got an opportunity to follow these along. The T90 mechanism was used as a way of being able to support international fellows or students as well as U.S. citizens. One final example of the kinds of things that we've been interested in. So we've talked so far about the Center Cores, a microarray consortium, the informatics framework, and training. But this is really developing resources now. And this was 200 mouse lines that we wanted to offer the neuroscience community. These would be Cree driver lines that would allow for either temporal or spatial specific expression and knockouts in mice. This was done through NIMH, and Andrea Beckel-Michener was the program head on this. In a way, this is one of the surprises, because we had expected that it would be difficult to get the 200 lines. The applications we got in were really very novel in terms of some of the technologies that were put in place, including a really interesting enhancer trap method. I think we'll have no trouble getting 200. We've probably got more than that already in the first few months of this project. But this is one of the other areas where we think we'll be able to, again, provide resources to the field that would not have been done as easily through a single IC. And actually, there'd be no reason to do that because, again, these would be for across the field. This will follow much of what we're doing with COMP, with deposition and the MMRCs, and with broad access to the community. Just a picture of what we expect this to look like. These are using some of the GenSat mice GenSat has also been expanded through the blueprint, and these are now back recombinase mice that have a Cre driver put into them, and you can just see these different patterns of expression for a series of genes that have been looked at, which provide us for the first time the ability to do very spatially restricted cell-specific knockouts. And it's not simply a matter of doing the mapping, but this gives us actually the mice for physiological studies that can be done thereafter. I'm going to turn this over to Story and let her tell you about the opportunities we had to move from the kind of specific projects in 05 and in 06 to theme-specific projects in 07, 08, and 09.
So we had found for the first several years the notion of looking for resources and tools that investigators studying the brain across a broad range of problems was a very fruitful strategy. But then we recognized that if NIH is about science, that maybe we should focus our efforts for the next several years on scientific themes that cut across the different institutes. So at a retreat, summer retreat, we brainstormed about what were common research themes that would be applicable to research programs in most of the institutes and came up with three. The first is neurodegeneration, and without much work, you can recognize that NINDS is interested in neurodegeneration. Macular degeneration in the eye is the most common neurodegenerative disease, hearing loss through loss of neurons, neurotoxicity, and drug abuse. Every single institute that participates was influenced by this question. We had a meeting of investigators from across the country funded. Each institute got to nominate a couple of investigators interested in neurodegeneration. They came up with a number of suggestions of areas where advances would be important. And we then had solicitation for applications to look at biomarkers that would help us track neurodegeneration early on or in clinical trials. A particular wrinkle here was that those biomarkers, in the best of all possible cases, would be applicable both to animal models and to humans. Another initiative was on therapeutic delivery strategies. As I'm sure most of you know, one of the biggest problems for people who study the nervous system and want to do therapeutics is there is a barrier between the blood and the brain, and we are constantly struggling with how you overcome that barrier. We then, and those were quite successful, we then had two career development and training opportunities, interdisciplinary career development, which was a sabbatical program, and interdisciplinary postdoctoral training. This turned out not to be of as much interest as the first two scientific issues, and so we funneled money into applications from the first two. The second common theme is neurodevelopment. Some of our diseases at NINDS are developmental diseases. Child health obviously has a significant interest. Mental illnesses and addiction are now being recognized as developmental disorders. Again, we held a large conference and had investigators from across the country funded by every institute that participates, and they posed what they thought were the most important questions and the tools that they would need to answer them. And out of that, we have now several proposals. One is for outstanding antibodies, tested antibodies that can be used to look at developmentally important molecules. This sounds pretty mundane, but many of the commercial suppliers of antibodies produce antibodies that are expensive and not doing what they're supposed to do. So for the NIH to actually support an antibody-generating facility where the antibodies actually do what they should and are affordable turned out to be an extremely attractive thought. Tools for marking neural circuits. It's very difficult to understand neural circuitry. We tend to do things one neuron at a time, but to be able to trace circuits seemed important. And to extend our efforts in gene expression from the mouse through the GenSat project and also the Allen Library, which has been a private activity, to gene expression maps in the primate brain seemed to be of significant interest to this group. The third theme is neuroplasticity. We have just had that meeting, and I attended most of it and was very interested to see how many of the investigators who came to this meeting, which bridged from plasticity in very simple circuits to plasticity in stroke recovery, had actually never met each other. So there were lively discussions, a little social engineering in addition to the science. And we are still in the process of sorting through the suggestions from that and coming up with a few focused initiatives. So these were the three scientific themes, and we are now trying to decide what strategy we'll pursue next for 10, 11, and 12. Now, I think it's worth going through what we think were some of the successes of the blueprint, and this is something that Alan asked us to focus on. I think the first thing is that while there was collaboration before, and there's good evidence of that, this blueprint effort has certainly increased collaboration across the ICs at all levels. There are program directors working together on specific projects. There is a blueprint coordinating committee with one representative from each institute. And the institute directors meet once a month, every month, for an hour to an hour and a half. And I would say that that has been one of the rules. Most of the time, three-quarters of the institute directors are there, and there are lots of interesting topics related to Blueprint as well as others that come up. Another success, I think, is that at the very beginning, based on the roadmap model, we decided that there should be a tithe on all the institutes that participate, and that that tithe would be related to the proportion of their budget that goes into neuroscience. So we have a pot of money dedicated every year, to which Dr. Zerhouni has also contributed, and so there's a significant incentive for thinking about how we best invest that. The planning meetings, as I've already said, engage disparate neuroscience research communities. If you're funded by NIDA, doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be interacting with NINDS or NEI investigators. We've created enhanced resources for the extramural community, and Tom has told you about some of those. We've created new training programs. We also have been able, as a collection of institutes, to deal with requests for information or dollars from the IOM, OSTP. So instead of each institute getting nickeled and dimed, we can together look at the proposal and say, this is actually of interest to all the neuroscience institutes, and make those contributions. I think it's made it easier once the other outside groups have figured out this is the way to go for them. And their interactions with the roadmap. So the neuroscience institutes have an add-on to the molecular libraries, which is funds to help neuroscience molecular libraries assays actually go to the next step. So I think it's actually worked extraordinarily well. Challenges. Lots of people don't know about the blueprint, despite the fact that we have a link on the front page of the NIH website. We don't know about the value of the databases, in particular the neuroscience informatics framework. We don't know how useful that will be. Intramural has only been involved in planning meetings. There have not been intramural projects per se. We've also found it difficult to make headway on some particular issues. So each of the institutes has a diversity training effort, which are running largely independent of each other. And it's very clear, just as we have now joint training grants in computational neuroscience and in neurobiology of disease, we could certainly enhance our efforts in increasing the diversity of our workforce if we could have a more unified effort. And it's on the list of things to do, but it's been harder than we would have thought. Limited funds for projects. Because of the limited funds, you know, it's a tithe, although there's been extra money from Dr. Zerhouni. It's hard to figure out how you can get the most bang for your buck, and so I think we've had tension between large, high-impact projects and smaller, short-term initiatives that allow funds to recycle more quickly. I am sure if the budget were going up, people would be... Well, there'd be more money in the pot because it's a percentage, but people also might be willing to have a larger percentage. And we, like Roadmap, are struggling with incubator projects versus longer-term support. And an obvious example of this is we set up three sets of training programs. Those were funded for 5 years. At the end of that time, do they get picked up by institutes, or do they continue to be in the blueprint? Because obviously we won't have trained all the computational neuroscientists that are of interest to all the institutes in that time. And I've discussed with you the themes post-2009. Do we recycle neurodegeneration, neurodevelopment, neuroplasticity? Do we come up with specific topics? For example, pain is one topic that's been suggested as a possibility. So I don't think we've come to grips with that. So what have we learned? Process counts. We have a lot of process, and it actually means that things happen and happen in a predictable and transparent fashion. I think having all the IC directors involved has been critical, and Duane and Paul and Jeremy and Jim can comment on that. Having contributions of funds, everybody has a commitment. There's money in the pot. And I think we've learned a lot about consensus building and compromise. Each of us brings to that table a different mission and a different level, and getting the balance between epidemiological studies, pediatric imaging database, mice has been an effort, but I think we've come up with a very broad range of issues, and that people are comfortable with the way the investments have been made. We think small catalytic investments can make a difference. So for the microarray consortium, the blueprint added one center to the three pre-existing centers, and you can see that that one center has made a huge difference in accessibility of the microarray center to neurosciences broadly. We've learned the importance of recognizing staff contributions. People work really hard on these projects. We have a awards ceremony in the summer. Dr. Zerhouni comes, and to get recognition for something that you're doing that's not your day job or has become your day job is important. We've struggled a bit with the optimal group size. We have 16 participating people. Not everybody is invested to the same level. I don't think it's been, it's not a huge problem, but it turns out that there are probably 7 or 8 core contributors, and if we were to do it again, maybe we wouldn't have it as broad. You could also argue that there are institutes like NHLBI, NIDDK, NCI, which do fund neuroscience research, whose contribution may be larger than some of the participating institutes, and they're not a piece. So size is an issue. And I think one of the most important things that we've learned is that there are wonderful new opportunities. Looking at the retina in Alzheimer's, and also collaboration on clinical trials. Each of the institutes runs a clinical trial, but we haven't had in the past any formulaic way of adding on to an eye institute trial on vitamins, looking at retinal degeneration, cognitive measures, or auditory measures. And so one of the big projects that Tom didn't mention is the creation of a toolbox of measures of nervous system function. It's kind of like a Chinese menu. So you could take one from column A, one from column B, and could piggyback those measures onto a clinical trial that any one of the NIH institutes is running. So that's what we wanted to present, and I would invite the other members of the blueprint to add their thoughts on either the projects, the what's worked, what hasn't worked so well, and what we've learned before opening it up to general questions. And Jeremy, of course, is a member of this.
Well, thank you, Tom and Story. And if we could get the lights on, I think we should start with just what Story said. So would others like to tell us about their experiences in the blueprint?
Yeah, this has been a major undertaking.
in terms of staff efforts and time involved and so forth. The question has been, has it been worth it? And I think the answer is yes. Staff has had a significantly increased workload, but they've also enjoyed what they're doing. It's broadened their horizons and their perspectives. They've, I think, enjoyed getting to know their colleagues in other institutes, and it's been pretty much a positive experience. Clearly, we've been able to do things with the pooled resources that we would not have been able to do otherwise. And it's also been an opportunity for us to push for things within our own institute's program and perspectives that fit into the whole, but again, might not have gotten done otherwise. Story mentioned the neuroimaging components in pediatrics that was part of a larger neuroimaging thing, where we were able to emphasize the fact that there's a developmental process going on here, and we have to understand what's normal at different ages and stages in terms of both physical structural imaging as well as functional. And we've been able to do that with the resources from the blueprint. So I think it's been a positive experience. There's no way of getting around the fact that there's been a lot of additional work for staff, but the complaints have been minimal, and I think that the experience has been pretty much a positive one.
Duane, if I could just ask, there's been a lot of discussion with OPASI. Paul sitting next to you is one example, talking about staff time for these trans or cross-cutting things that are really beyond what people's normal day job is. You mentioned it twice. It's obviously a big issue. Are there ways to basically staff up for these things as we go forward, or what are the real issues there?
Well, I think that some of the institutes have, in fact, had to staff up for coverage for these. We've had to do it minimally, but I think NIMH and neurology have had to staff up much more significantly than the rest of us have in order to provide coverage for this intensified activity. But even the existing staff is working harder and longer, and in areas that are maybe a little bit different than they would have been otherwise. But as I say, there have been complaints and concerns expressed, but for the most part, I think that they've enjoyed the expanded experience, but additional help would certainly have been welcomed.
I mean, I think that the benefit is the blueprint has provided a venue in which program directors from the iInstitute, NICHD, NINDS, NIMH, depending on the particular project and team, who otherwise would not have worked closely with people from other institutes, have been able to do that. And I think friendships and partnerships have been created, which has made it easier. If a grant needs to get transferred, you need to know who you call to transfer it. So I think it's made a more of a syncytium at the program director level than previously existed, and certainly that's been true at the institute director level.
Well, I would agree that with all that has been said, and would only add that for us, the greatest benefit has been an opportunity to become better acquainted with the activities in the other larger neuroscience institutes, and to find ways both within and outside the blueprint of working together with other institutes to do things that perhaps we might not have been able to do on our own given the budget constraints under which we live.
You know, as somebody in, the peripheral nervous system a little bit, I think NIGMS has benefited tremendously from our participation. I think, you know, the access to some of the common resources as well as the interactions between a couple of staff people from NIGMS who've been involved, I think has been very, very positive. I mean, I think for me, the comments have all been positive, that the staff people involved have enjoyed both getting to know people across the ICs, but also to have a venue to bring ideas, which NIGMS would never do on its own, but impact the science that we support. So,
one of the outcomes that would be interesting to look at, Alan, in terms of what OPASI could add here, is, I showed you the data for the number of collaborative projects in 2004. One concern we had in the beginning was that that might actually go down now that the blueprint was there as a framework for collaboration. There have been a number of things that have come up in the last 2 or 3 years, which were not of interest to all of the blueprint institutes, but were of interest to 3 or 4 of them. And my own sense, although we haven't done the count, so it would be worth looking at it more closely, is that having this social engineering, the syncytium already formed, is actually facilitated more non-blueprint, we could call them blueprint-associated efforts, in which groups of institutes, smaller groups, maybe 3 institutes, began doing something together that would not have happened, perhaps, prior to this.
Just a question of whether or not the ICs think that you've been willing to take on riskier projects as a result, because I can see the social engineering working in 2 ways. One, willingness to take on risky, but also with consensus-driven, actually leaning toward actually the less riskier projects through an effort like this.
So this would be, maybe Paul would want to respond. Just very quickly, my own sense was that's part of what's behind that bullet about optimal group size. I think when you get to 16 people around the table, it's very difficult, just as we talk about in peer review, to support the kind of out-of-the-box innovative idea.
But riskier can show up in different ways, and the social engineering here has been very good to have a mechanism for all of us to be sitting at the table. I remember a discussion of what mouse background one should be putting these mutations in, and Jim and I looked at each other in mutual horror, because one of the strains has an older age hearing loss and the other one had a massive retinal degeneration defect. And I can imagine that studying central processes in the mouse CNS without lack of vision input might well skew the results. So I think it's some simple but and subtle things that could actually save considerable money. From the eye perspective, from the NEI perspective, this has been very important. We have been staffing up for this. It's given me a little bit of cover even to augment the discipline of visual neuroscience and to expand the definition of visual neuroscience beyond simply CNS processing of visual signals, but in fact to take it into retinal degenerations and so the entirety of the eye. It helps us as an institute look at how science is structured in a different way. That's also a message that I've been able to take to the extramural community and to the professional organizations. We have many ophthalmology department chairs that have departments into which grants are going. And for those department chairs to hear the idea that vision is part of neuroscience is a very strong message that, in fact, they're starting to resonate with. And I think this has a ripple effect beyond just the table we're sitting at in terms of the social dynamic.
But I'd like an opportunity to address Raynard's question, because I think it's pretty clear to me that when you get 16 people around the table and try to come to consensus, you don't often tumble to something that's risky. Usually you tumble to something that's obvious, because it's easy to develop consensus around something that's obvious, and it's more difficult to develop consensus around something that's risky. The interesting thing that I've noticed is every time we've called in the scientific community and asked them what they want from us, they want tools, they want antibodies, they want really old-fashioned stuff, but they want good stuff that's been validated that they can count on. And so here at NIH, we're not the only ones that are conservative. It turns out the research community, at least the ones that we sample, turn out to be pretty conservative too when you ask them what they want. Never have I heard anybody say they want support for risky projects at one of these get-togethers.
So, if I may, I think this is a wonderful way to leverage our precious resources, both people and finances, but it seems to me to be a real opportunity to really emphasize interoperability as you develop collaborations and initiate new adventures in terms of developing databases and common nomenclature and ways of collecting data so that you're not reinventing the wheel every time we issue a new initiative. and seems to me should be a tenant of the blueprint.
So that's what the toolbox story mentioned is trying to do, and that's a broad effort that started as, I think, three institutes, NIA, NINDS, NIMH, and then developed as a blueprint initiative to kind of expand it out to do just what you're describing in a much more sort of clinically applicable form.
So I would even argue that that is, in some senses, a high-risk project. Imagine if every clinical trial that NHLBI ran on controlling blood pressure or cholesterol had added to it a visual assay, quick visual assay, an auditory assay, and a cognitive assay. That could transform our ability to collect information on a variety of diseases, and it's high risk to think that you will be able to come up with column A, B, and C, and in a sense it's also high risk to think that we'll get institutes to embrace this notion. Who wants to clutter up their clinical trial with ancillary measures? And I would say that that was reasonably controversial.
I just wanted to add from the NCIR point of view, our involvement in the blueprint has been a very productive and a rewarding experience. It essentially has actually made the kinds of jobs that we do easier. We, in the areas of comparative medicine, the animal models, and in the informatics contributions that we've been able to make, we have generally been making, we have found and been more efficient in being able to do things because of our interactions through the blueprint activities. And I think we've also been able to make contributions to the overall effort. So I think it's been a very rewarding and a positive activity and one that we embrace. In terms of workload, I would say, certainly, of course, it has gone up, but it is the kind of work we want to be doing. So it's exactly the area that we should be working on.
Thank you. Story, you mentioned interdisciplinary training very quickly. Within the roadmap, we talk a lot about interdisciplinary programs. Neuroscience seems in many ways to be sort of a granddaddy of them all, the idea of neurologists, psychiatrists, neurosurgeons, other types of people in the different suits work together. How has that worked? Is there really, do people out there want this interdisciplinary training? Is there getting them to adapt?
I do think that's the case. The pilot for interdisciplinary neuroscience training actually preceded the blueprint by 8 or 10 years. When Zach Hall came here as the NINDS director, he managed to convince a number of the institutes to pool their resources for the first 2 years of pre-doctoral training into joint training grants so that there's one per institution. All the places that train neuroscientists have their trainers participate in this. And that was actually, after a small hesitation, embraced by the neuroscience community. And what it meant was that anybody who trained neuroscience graduate students in ophthalmology, physiology, pharmacology, biochemistry, neuroscience departments belonged to this common training program and worked together to come up with curriculum recruitment. And so that, interestingly enough, that program actually is Blueprint affiliated, wasn't moved into the Blueprint because while there are lots of institutes that are Blueprint institutes that support it, the Blueprint as a whole felt that it wouldn't bring particular more value and we should just leave that alone. My sense for the neurobiology of disease training, we require that had representation from a broad range of departments and a broad range of diseases. So you couldn't get funded if you just did psychiatric diseases or if you just did neurodegenerative diseases. You had to have a broad range. So I think people have embraced the opportunity for these new programs. And, we will see if when they come in for renewal, however that's funded, whether it was controlled by psychiatry or neurology or whatever. But I think it's an experiment, and I think it's working. I don't know. Tom, do you want to?
Well, it's a little bit different than some of the other areas that NIH plays in, because this is a, you take some specific examples, synaptic plasticity. That's neuroscience training. What institute would that belong in? You can name 7, 8 for which that's relevant. Even a neurotransmitter like dopamine, retina, drug addiction, schizophrenia, Parkinson's. I mean, so the fundamentals here just are not IC-specific. So why should the training be? That's what led to this even before the blueprint, and we could then grow it up a little bit better with this framework.
So the we also, when we did a portfolio analysis, no one had a training grant in computational neuroscience. There were computational neuroscientists on some training grants, but there were no computational neuroscience training grants, and there were no imaging training grants. There were imagers as part of other training grants. So here were two very important disciplines in neuroscience which didn't have formal training grants to reward programs that were to coalesce programs and then reward them that were doing the best training. Now, 5 years from now, there may be two or three other areas where the blueprint might say this is where we need to foster training, and NIMH will pick up one of the computational ones, and INDS will pick up one, and, you know, so the future's a little of those training programs is complicated.
Boy, it's interesting what 4 good bottles of wine gets you to.
You should have brought 12.
That's right. It's giving me some thoughts, because I think in some ways, you know, what's the chicken, what's the egg? I mean, when you say neuroscience blueprint is working, the program directors like it, and the scientists that we bring together, there's consensus that builds up. And I wonder, and you say something, process counts, but there's substance, there has to be some scientific substance. And I'm wondering to what extent that's being recognized. I think there is scientific convergence, which really is driving fundamentally the need for investments across, like the themes, the emergence of themes. You, 15 years ago, I don't think you would have had that opportunity. Common mechanisms of disease that are common across, we just heard plasticity, or degeneration, protein aggregation, and so on. So I think there is a balance between what science is driving all of us to, as consensus or not consensus, and what you need to do to adapt the group, like you said, social engineering, and that's a very good analogy, actually, because you can see value in the interaction much more than you see value in the components of the interactions. But I think there's a sense that the sense I have is that there's a natural evolution. When you do something different, you know, you try to remove the obstacles to it, and you've done that by putting money in the pot so that nobody comes to the discussion thinking about their wallets. And it's done. We're going to do the best we want to do. And then you try to do something that is unique. So the sense I have is it's true that if you ask the scientific community, a lot of it is tools that are lacking, mechanisms that are lacking, the ability to find training in an interdisciplinary environment. The CTSCs are a good example of that. At the end of the day, the process led to the discovery that you couldn't have the structures that were in place do what you wanted done in the context of this new science, and you came to the conclusion that that dog won't hunt, we need a new dog. And that sometimes happens, and I'm wondering what, within the neuroscience blueprint folks, what is driving that conversation? Because I think when you start these things, the first thing is what I call the perspirational stage, the pain of having staff work harder, come together, come to meetings, and, you know, there's perspiration in trying to make something happen. Then the second stage is aspirational. You know we have this. There's a vague aspiration that this is something that actually creates value, and I think we're at that stage now. Everybody's realizing there's value. And the third is inspirational. In other words, how do you then create a neuroscience blueprint that is really inspirational and driving the thought processes of the field? You've already moved to that because you've changed your topics from tools to degeneration, I mean, fundamental. And I'm wondering if there's a next stage relating to this high risk, high impact, and whether or not you want to get into that sort of profile. And let me be specific. I just gave a talk to the American Neurological Association, and as I was preparing, there were a few things that really became obvious. Number one is if you look at the awardees in the Pioneer Awards, if you look at the awardees in the New Innovator Awards, if you look at the conversations I have with members in the Academy, the Nobel winners, and so on, it is amazing how much neuroscience is like pent up. I mean, you can see a bubbling up of energy in the neuroscience field with young people being interested in it. I talk to people, postdocs, and they all say the frontier is neuroscience. There's excitement. There's inspiration coming out of that. How do we capture that is one. The second observation I made is that we are on the leading edge of a wave which is triggered by this genome-wide association studies and so on, that I think the blueprint needs to surf and be ahead of the wave. What I mean by that is this, and I'm going to give you again a specific example as a model example, and that's the MS from Steve Hauser's paper in the New England Journal of Medicine. So here's a scientist, and I had a conversation with Story and him. Here's a scientist who was looking at MS for years, just not like our folks here, and they collaborated and so on, and they really suspected for a long time that MS had something to do with the immune system because the HLA story had been actually discovered 30 years ago. But you couldn't really get deeper than that because you really had no idea how to go about it. And you had, as you know, you have 27 interleukins and a very complex immune system. And so they started to collaborate with groups overseas and here and finally found, a little bit like the macular degeneration story, IL-2 and IL-7 with the receptors and very specific. Well, the number of questions that then come downstream of these fundamental observations in it is enormous. And if you really sit down for a minute and you say, okay, what are the implications of this sort of observations and how is that going to shift the magnetic forces of the neuroscience field, you realize that you may be looking at a tsunami of approaches and needs in neuroscience that you never had before. Because it's absolutely very different, in fact, to study the immune system in the context of MS as they want to do. First thing is therefore, how can the neuroscience blueprint sort of take into account these undercurrents of what is lacking tools that we would like to have to do what we want to do today, but what is likely to be lacking of approaches and innovations that I think need to be spelled out. So you made a comment, Tom, it's a neuroscience loop or story, so that it may not be as recognized out there. My recommendation is use the neuroscience blueprint as a flag for inspiration for what is now coming to the front in neuroscience. So implication of neurogenomics and what are those implications and what are the box things do we need to do today to encourage that. The CTSAs, I also told the American Neurological Association, by default, we said that all the CTSAs could combine GCRC funds and non-specific T32s. But the new policy is going to be that there will be a proportionality between the new investments that NIH makes in this that is proportional to your willingness to create a home, a real home, for training the new generation of clinician scientists. So can the Neuroscience Institute sort of almost hijack the resource, if you will, by telling their people, look, if you want to pull in, we're okay if you put your T32 common neuroscience, but if you do that, then we insist that there be a specific translational science track for neuroscience, which will include A, B, C, D, so that instead of being reactive, you become proactive in framing the debate within the community. The other thing is I believe, and I think we should do this with OPASI and the roadmap, I really think that now is the time to formally identify what the grand challenges in science and neuroscience are. And there are other mechanisms, I think, that we haven't used. And I'm really interested in this NSF experiment on grand prizes for grand challenges, you know, like spell out a problem, where you can have all these bunch of young scientists, you know, sort of fight for some great idea. You said protein capture is something that came up during the roadmap and specific recognition of molecular informational sites and or the networking of neurons. So I don't know what those may be. But so I would say that from what I hear, I think you're doing a great job. I mean, I have to tell you, I'll pay the next bottles, no question. This is great because it does relate to the convergence of science. But I think you go from, you know, okay, this is perspiration, this is the aspiration, now is the inspiration stage. And I think the inspiration has to be based on this yearning that you can feel in the neuroscientific community across the board. Would it be NIDA when you talk to Nora and the folks who look at all of the commonality of circuitry between depression and reward systems and on and on. And so I think there has to be maybe a neuroscience blueprint statement of inspiration or aspiration, whatever, something is that would excite everyone, because I think the key thing for us is to be intellectual leaders as well as providers of grants and mechanisms. So,
one of the, if I can respond to part of that, Elias, we had a we had now three meetings of the community where we've brought about 30, 40 scientists in, one group for development, one for neurodegeneration, and recently for plasticity. And we always put a sign up when they come in that we're not here to talk about mechanisms. You tell us what it is that's the biggest roadblock to progress and how you'd like to solve it. We'll figure out the mechanism. That's our job. We want you to sort of lay out the landscape for us. What you described about the opportunities in genomics, and we heard this from Eric Lander at the retreat, where for these various institutes, there may be 50, 60, 80 new candidates that will become available over the next few months in this deluge, as he described it. That's part of what, I mean, I think we had that vision already, part of what led to the development of the mice and the development of this this program for identifying circuit formation and how circuits develop, and this whole the whole discussion about what's happening in neural development that's being driven by genomic variation, which we have a very, very primitive understanding of at this point. It really did come down to tools. What we realized we needed was a pipeline of tools to be able to go from stem cells to flies to mice and maybe even to gene expression in primates to try to understand how genomic variation plays out in the brain and what it means. So we got that. Putting it together is going to take more than what we can do just with the blueprint, but I think we're beginning to get pieces of it glued together. What would be really nice would then be to formalize it or to formulate it as a true pipeline of discovery that allows us to go in a kind of reverse translation from something that comes out of a whole genome association study for MS, let's say, to very quickly figure out what that means in terms of brain development and synaptic plasticity and circuit formation.
You know, there's a deep concern. You know, we are all sort of excited and enthusiastic about the genomics approach, but there's a very good group, I mean, maybe a minority, but a strong minority of very high-level scientists who have deep, deep reservations about all these genome-wide association studies. I'm sure you've heard them. There are methodological concerns about the fact that to find those flags, those associations, because association is not causation, you need to combine data. The fundamental flaw that people are focusing on right now is the fact that you not only combine populations in a different background, but you're making 500,000 to 1 million observations per individual, and then you combine that as if this was one uniform data set. So that's how you come up with the 10 minus 10 p-value. The other very, very important criticism is the fact that when you look at this population, like the diabetes, the most formulated criticism I've heard, and this is not from sort of, you know, sour grapes, these are very thoughtful scientists, is the following. Say, well, that study was done, every factor is 20%, you know, odd ratio of having the disease, and then when you look at those who have it, those who don't, many have the mutation in MS, for example. I mean, that, this is one of the most common genomic variant in the human population that they're focusing on. So it's not like, gee whiz, 90% of the patients have it and 0% of the non-patients have it. And what they think is that you need to get to the next step of refining the analysis. For example, in the case of diabetes, when you look at the 30,000, first of all, the phenotyping was different from one study to the other. The one that had glucose tolerance with really a gradation of the disease at same age group, same control, was very little. If you really think about looking at that population, you realize that there isn't a fine-comb analysis of the phenotype, which means that when you do these associations, really you haven't enriched the sample to find out which ones to go after. What they say is that the risk is you're getting this, and then you're not doing the intermediate analysis where you should take the patients who have retinal disease plus neuropathy plus this as one group at the edge. Just like Dr. Hobbs was showing us with her finding of the KSC9 gene, and say, okay, I'm going to take this, and I'm going to take these people with diabetes who really go on for 30 years with no complications, and that's what I'm going to do. So that sort of downstream studies that need to be done with much more accurate sub-classification, phenotyping, and so on, if you don't say now that, hey, this is important, or you agree or disagree that they're important, what you may end up with is 80 R01 requests about every which way combination, sub-combination of every which gene that is, you know, being put out as a red flag out there. I'm just going into the weeds here, but that to me is the role of the neuroscience blueprint, to bring out the fundamental scientific, not only roadblocks, but the scientific conceptual tensions that exist at all times, and just make them you know, fight it off and see what the best way is.
There's no question that the risk that you've outline for genome-wide association studies is absolutely clear. There's also no question that stratification of the population can tease out genetic effects, often representing genome changes that are really present in only a small fraction of the population. So I think the key here is in the data analysis and the way that it's done, and getting some really, really bright biostatisticians and others involved in analyzing the data in a variety of different ways, because the data sets, if collected correctly and the phenotyping is pretty deep, are potentially very, very rich in information.
Yeah, and can take the counterpoint to that. That is that that's true, but every time you stratify, you lose statistical power. And you try to recover it through manipulations, but most people would say, wait a minute. You know, just like when people did enzyme identification in the 30s and 40s, purification of the sample was the key. You know, quality of the sample was the key. Do we have the machine, the engines? Well, I would say no, we don't, because we never really needed to have these cohorts that are extremely well characterized, extremely well identified, so that you can, in fact, do those at statistical powers that are reasonable, because you have not just looked at the stratification, but you've looked at the purity of the noise level within the sample so that you can do it. That's a technical conversation, but clearly what that means to me is that when you say, oh, well, we need to combine retinal observations with hearing loss and so on and so forth, Well, look at the permutations of that, and that might actually lead to a neuroscience blueprint strategy that needs to be explicitly expressed. That's what I mean by intellectual leadership. Go ahead of that wave intellectually, not with dollars. I mean, intellectually.
So it's interesting. You mentioned grand challenges, and I think we've recognized themes. We've recognized the need for tools to get rid of roadblocks, but I don't think we've actually sat down and tried to articulate 3, 5, 10 grand challenges, and that might be a way to capture broader excitement in the community. And it's interesting, there is an IOM neuroscience forum that a number of us participate in, and there's some interest sparked by Kathy Olson from the NSF to think about what are the grand challenges in neuroscience, like what is dark matter? So my first response to that was, what do you mean the IOM Forum should be doing this? This is something a blueprint should be doing, and maybe we need to gain control over that. But, you know, if you had 6 questions, grand challenges, that could be a very effective way to...
I think we started that in one sense, though. We've taken the first pass, which was development and generation plasticity. Those are not specific questions, but we picked out those areas out as... No, but that's the next step. So we had outside community people there, and there was a rather rich discussion. And beyond the tools that were in need, at least they are now thinking across discipline. And I think when you get to a grand challenge, it's going to be cross organ system. And I think that could...
And you see, I think you need to do that work. It's hard. It's very hard. But the fact is, that is the answer to not end up with lowest common denominator consensus. Because left, you know, there's an analogy I like to give. Say, well, you always want to have people move out of the box, right? And our job is simply to remove the walls. And my observation is you remove the walls, and those folks still keep playing with each other, you know, and don't realize the walls are gone, and let's go find another pile of sand. You need to do 2 things. You need to remove the passive obstacles, but you also need to say, you know what, there's better cheese over there. And maybe there is an opportunity for you to, you know, we'll give you an expeditionary grant so that you can go and do it. That is, in fact, what I would dream for the neuroscience blueprint, to not be just a mechanism, a process, but to be a flag bearer for exciting neuroscience and exciting the scientists, not the existing ones, but the new ones. You know, it's like, what's the moonshot or what's the Sputnik story for neuroscientists to go on? And I tell you, that is the next step for this great way of doing things that you've already come up with. And nothing is more exciting. I tell you, we can see it. 14 out of 39 Pioneer Awards is the most won group. Jeremy wants to talk about that. But.
Well, this year it was 8 out of 12, or are pretty close to neuroscience. And that was something that we didn't realize until sort of fairly late in the process. We were like, oh, we sort of go through when we're working on press releases and so on. And it's like, is there any sort of a theme? It was like, yeah, they're all neuroscientists. Maybe we should play this down because it looks like we're...
How did those other 4 get in there, Jeremy? Because we thought that...
Well, they'll be doing neuroscience by the end of the awards.
So. You mean like all good immunologists, they finally discover the brain?
Yeah, most of the others have applications that they are not.
You know, there's nothing that drives a field intellectually, in my view, more than some unsolved, well spelled out problem, you know. Not at the 100,000 foot view, oh yeah, we need to understand how circuits get together, bro. Well, that's boring. But something like the, you know, I'm trying to share with you what I believe in, and that is that, you know, in my personal career, I was fascinated by the Hilbert's 23 mathematical problems and the Fermat theorem, which lasted 250 years. The thing that's amazing is that every single one of these challenges or vision of what needs to be done has led to fundamental breakthroughs. Every everybody who's worked around them made progress, even if they didn't solve the problem. For example, I know that one of the early attempts at resolving the Fermat theorem led to the understanding of topology of mathematical space, which now is used in complex graph theory for understanding very, very complex issues of distribution of resources and so on. And it has nothing to do with solving the problem. It never solved the problem that way, but it was important to do it that way. I wonder to what extent that's not also the case here. I can see, for example, the issue of growing and maintaining neuronal cultures over time functionally is a really an interesting problem. And the fact that now you have the slice and you have that has generated new prospects for science. What would that be? I mean, what would be the X Prize for neuroscience or the X Prizes for neuroscience? That's why I think you need to sort of put that pinata out there and say, the scientific pinata, what is it that would be so exciting that not only do you get the programs and everybody, but you get the whole thing going. So that's a way to get around high risk.
I was just going to say, one of the Pioneer awardees, I mean, one example of a problem, her proposal was about trying to get a much better structural understanding of what really happens when a synapse weakens or strengthens. And it's, you know, it's one of these very, very fundamental questions where the answer is we kind of know something happens and there are some molecules involved and they're encoded by some genes. But in terms of, you know, drawing a picture of this is a strong synapse and this is a weak synapse and this is what happened. And, you know, she's moving very dramatically from what she'd done in the past to try to get much more involved in imaging, which he thinks is the solution to that problem, or at least a big step toward it.
Picking up on, Ilias, your idea about association studies and the blind leads, false leads that you can potentially get into, I think Roger and International's arena really fits into that. The Eye Institute is fortunate in eye diseases to have well phenotypable diseases. You can look in and begin to stage things by rather coarse observations, but in fact they seem to have validity on a graded scale. I think there's a great opportunity to go to Hyderabad or some of the other areas in India and find these populations and at least verify and vet the first pass of GWAS leads, associations that are coming up.
Listening to this and thinking about the history with Huntington's, because there are lots of people in this country with Huntington's disease. There are several hundred thousand with Huntington's genes, but you had to go to Maracaibo to the descendants of a single individual who came in the 1820s or so to have a density of population that was so uniform that you could do the GWAS study in 1,000 people instead of a massive throw of the net. So I think the international stuff is, I'm sitting here because we have a number of international projects in brain disorders. Some of them are absolutely fascinating. And things like epilepsy in Africa, the stigma that's associated with it makes these people anathema in the population. They don't survive. They don't survive because they're stigmatized, not because of their disease. And it opens up other issues about care treatment and genetics, how they get there. Is it cystopsychosis is the cause of their epilepsy, or is it some other factor?
So this gets a little bit to one of the, I think, problems with the blueprint. So there are a lot of really exciting scientific opportunities, but to the extent that they become disease-specific, they're IC-specific. So the blueprint would never go there. The blueprint might be interested, if you had a gene, in figuring out what it does to neural or retinal development, because it's getting at some fundamental principle of neuroscience. But this is there's this space of a very important translational research which we haven't really invaded. And I'm not sure how we would do that except to provide some of the underpinning, some of the principles that could then be used by an IC that was specifically interested in macular degeneration.
Does the intervention of cystopsychosis on the nerve, I mean, I don't know the mechanism, I'm not a neuroscientist, but that certainly evokes it perturbates the system and gives you an outcome. I don't know if that's a would fit into the basic issues as a...
So I bring it up, in part of what we're here for, is to help those who aren't in the neuroscience blueprint, but maybe thinking about other trans efforts, inflammation, you could imagine a number of them, to think about what the challenges are and where the problems are. This is a point of tension, that issues that become too disorder-specific really move out of blueprint space for the most part. And I'm not sure that's a problem, but it is a realization. And it will probably be true for other trans IC efforts, unless they can stay within sort of a basic principle that underlies the physiology or pathophysiology of a number of disorders.
Yeah, I think I would agree with Tom. You don't want to lose, to be all things to all people, then you lose your value, which which to me the blueprint is really the converging areas of science and the future areas of science, trying to make sure that you get there and build a bridge to that. I have another question I'd like to go back to, and that's the role of the intramural program. You touched upon it. Is there a sense, because I think, again, because of the excitement in neurosciences, you know, we did this intramural, trans-NIH intramural and roadmap exercise, and one of the advantages of neuroscience blueprints that you're topic-specific, one of the disadvantages I find in conversing about roadmap is that it's hard to explain. You can't be specific because you're not disease-specific or... And yet, at the same time, it's been an enormously helpful tool to converse with Congress and internally as well to do the social engineering thing that you need to do when science converges. But the intramural program, from my standpoint, again, there's these two dimensions, but better synergy, but also breakthroughs and do something different. So we came out with the systems biology and inflammation, you know, remember those topics. What is your view about neuroscience in the intramural program?
So I have to say that from my scientific director, there was a perception that the immunology community here at NIH has been incredibly well organized for decades. They have a common retreat. They have very strong programs in most of the institutes. And they were really poised and well organized to put forward a proposal. In fact, there was some sense that they'd actually been organized ahead of time to do this, and that the neurosciences probably could come up with, if there were an intramural, whatever, 1.5, could organize. So that was one issue. The immunologists are really well organized. The second piece, I think, is that neuroscience goes all the way from molecular machines of channels to fMRI imaging. And while you can get convergence between the channel people and the synapse people and the synapse people and the small circuit people and the small circuit people and the fMRI people, it's very difficult to span that whole community. And I think that there's a lot of cohesion and collaboration between the different groups, but that it's been more difficult to identify common areas between the groups, and that probably means that we've not recruited wisely enough. But I think, I don't know, Tom, do you want to add?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I think going forward, it's an opportunity. As we begin to formulate this, and I think you could begin to see it a bit in the history of this. We're in our, fourth year, in a sense, in terms of planning. We've become increasingly proactive. That is, we begin to lay out what the agenda is. I think the next challenge for us will be to say, if this is the problem to solve, which part could be done by intramural that we may want to do quickly, we may want to do offline, we may want to do it in a different way than we would do through a typical RFA, and which part do we want to have it done competitively through an extramural effort? We haven't really begun to address that, but that's an option. And I think it really comes down to what the scientific problem is and where the best solution is going to be. But that would be a very different discussion than what we've had up until now, because so far, for the most part, intramural has not been involved in the blueprint. Is that fair to say, Story?
So I would say, every meeting, there have been intramural participants who have melded well with the rest of the community. I think that the intramural neuroscience community got brought together through, there's now a single website that lists all intramural neuroscience investigators, and they're organized not by institute but by area of research. There is a Monday noontime seminar series which every institute contributes to, and there's an incredibly broad range of speakers, and there is the Porter Neuroscience Building, and I think kind of evolution beyond that may have to some extent stalled. Now, the Eye Institute has recruited a guy named Swaroop, who is very excellent person, very integrative, and he is beginning to talk with other institutes about how his recruitments can bridge the NEI Institute intramural program to what's in NINDS, what might be in NIAAA, what might be in deafness, to try to make a sensation. But because of the range from channels to lighting up the amygdala in an MRI, it's hard to get that kind of coherence. And I would say that we've heard from the neuroscience communities that they've been disappointed in that there's not been a more brainish proposal in roadmap. Now, I have tried to convince them that the channels initiative, membrane protein channels, is that. And I think we're actually going to discuss this at the IOM forum. But it breaks down. You get to one of those big meetings, and the channel guys head off in one direction, or the synapse guys head off in one direction, the behavioral people head off in another direction, and you can't get the kind of momentum that has happened for some of the other topics. Now, I mean, there's lots of neuroscience benefit for neuroscience in the roadmap, but none of the neuroscientists go and say, that's my, I really, like, in contrast to the human microbiome, which isn't even doing CSF.
Don't forget the National Centers for Biomedical Computing, too, which certainly have big neuroscience components.
Right, but someone has to say, but don't forget. It doesn't like, oh, my God, remember CODA.
But bottom line, as I look around the room, I don't see any intramural neuroscientists in this room to talk about the blueprint. There's an opportunity.
We didn't invite them.
Even more so. So there's an opportunity that hasn't been realized. Of course, it has issues that OPASI's been dealing with for roadmap, but this may be an opportunity to do something a little different.
We can just invite all the SDs to one of the directors' meetings and say, what could we do?
Yeah, I would encourage that because I'm worried that the intramural community feels left out. And really, the intramural program is different than what you can get in the extramural. They can go long-term, high-risk for leading-edge things to a greater extent than the extramural community can, at lower overhead, if you will, in terms of organizational. Maybe yes, maybe no. I'm not sure. Paul is.
If an applicant comes in with a great idea that spans a period of time, we hope that scientists, whether inside or outside, make some kind of progress over a period of time. If a project hits a brick wall and is dead end, I would hope inside that they might change their course also. So I'm not sure that there's really a hindrance outside.
Point well taken. My last question is political pushback. I've been surprised at how much pushback the various communities had about roadmap and taking away, destroying sciences, or blah blah blah. What is your experience from your advisory councils and so on? And, or maybe it's not large enough for them to worry, or what?
Roadmap has been the buffer. Really,
a blueprint can be seen as the same sort of problem, right? You're taking away from pool of R01s, and you're doing things instead of, this is Tony Fauci's, he says, oh, Elias, look, this is nothing new. I was like taken aback. So I thought these were good ideas, and the scientists themselves, he said, oh, look, there's a poll of people here that argue all the time about having great HIV vaccine centers. And once we agreed, the exact same people who advocated for this are the ones who signed the letter saying that we're not supporting basic microbiology. So he says, you know, there's this sort of relationship. And those who want the NIH leadership to basically be an ATM, not a coach, but a referee, just make sure the peer review is okay. We'll tell you what we want to do and just send the money. That was one, this one end. And then those who say, oh, you're not leadership enough. You're not really doing what needs to be done. Things are falling apart. So there's a whole spectrum, if you will, which is a diverse spectrum, which is good. This is what you want. No one knows where the answer is going to come from. But I'm curious to hear what your experience has been.
So I'm sure for our two institutes, it's been positive. I haven't gotten any pushback. It's not that much money. What about NEI or NIDCD?
Well, I like to talk anecdotes, so let me tell you about the Association of University Professors. When I started talking about neuroscience, they said, what's that? This is ophthalmology. And then I said, well, when you're at the cocktail party with the dean, if you say my Aunt Mabel has glaucoma, he'll say, I'm sorry for her. But if you say she has a neurodegeneration of ganglion cells, he'll say, oh, wow, we can work with that. Why don't you join the neurologists on campus? And the university professors kind of caught that message, and so wrapping up the anecdote, 2 years later, I'm walking down the hallway of the same meeting, and they're four over in the corner, and they're saying, my dean knows about neuroscience. And they were talking to themselves, not to me. So I think there is a message. The other part of it is that they then will come and ask, what are we getting out of this? How much of the roadmap money are we getting? And my answer is, well, have you put in any applications? Because what you put in is what you get out. And I think I think the vision community at least is, they're in equilibrium on both roadmap and blueprint.
The auditory community views the blueprint in a very positive light, and the reason for that is probably pretty obvious to everybody in the room, and that's that there's very few academic medical centers where there's more than a couple of laboratories whose primary focus is auditory neuroscience, which means they lack the critical mass in and of themselves to justify some of the high-end equipment and other things that are really needed to take a modern approach to science. And what the blueprint has done has brought them those resources, both in the training arena and in terms of the course, and they are deeply appreciative of that because they've been able to up their game enormously as a consequence. So for a small community that's scattered, like the one that our institute supports, and you could say the same for the chemosensory folks, that's a very similar story there, tend to be a few labs in one academic medical center, sometimes a single lab in an academic medical center. And without the sort of blueprint approach, these folks are basically left behind.
And if you think about it, at the Society for Neuroscience, which is the major basic neuroscience meeting of the year, 20,000, 25,000 people come, 38 this year. And interestingly enough, the part of that's growing the fastest is the translational and disease-related piece. This is like apple pie and motherhood. You know, neuroscience is one field. Of course, I get my one grant from NINDS, and I get a grant from NIDA. I get a grant from NIMH, and I get a grant from NIAAA. So the notion that the institutes are working together towards common goals is like, yeah. So and we've walked a very careful path between saying it's not a lot of money, but we're going to do important things with it. And so NINDS has had no pushback at all, enthusiastic support.
The operational word is catalytic.
Well, I really want to thank our two speakers for a great job and all of you for the rousing discussion.
Thank you.